get the treatment and antidepressants, and 7 months sober have built me a bed in the back of your brain where the memories flicker and I paw at the synapses, bright bits of string. You should know I am with you, know I forgive you, know I am proud of the steps that you've made. Know it will never be easy or simple. Know I will dig in my claws when you stray. So let us rest here like we used to, in a line of late afternoon sun. Let it rest, all you can't change. Let it rest and be done.
I remember these days in New York. I didn't have a job. The apartment always felt empty. We didn't have enough money to furnish it with anything other than my parents' couch. We foolishly painted the kitchen a dark and brooding green that sucked in what little light came from the shoebox-sized window. She was making $15 an hour downtown. It was 2008 on the northern tip of Manhattan. There was a park near the house, right where Broadway met Dyckman. During the day, there were only three types of people there. The doddering, the druggies, the dropouts, and me. I had learned at 19 that drinking could lift me out of my confusing inertia and at least give me the ability to reorient myself for a few hours. Drunk, with a bottle of Jack Daniels in my backpack, an arm with an iPod, I walked the 500 feet to the park and took a seat at the always abandoned swing set. I would swing for hours, constantly scanning the same small patch of dead inwood grass and wrestling with my brain about the finer points of a deep malaise. I wasn't sad so much as I had no belief in happiness at all. I wasn't tired so much that my natural state was prone, dormant, eyes closed. I wasn't stuck so much as resigned to the fact that I would never progress beyond this moment and would, in fact, remain as useless as a turtle flipped on his shell. Sisyphus with no strength left to roll the boulder up his hill. In fact, I mostly just felt like a boulder, heavy and immovable, pushed by the need to execute basic life functions, but always rolling right back down again, pulled by the gravity of my own stasis. I left the park with blisters on my hands from the chains of the swing set. I sat on the couch, turned on a video game, and thought of the lies I would have to tell my girlfriend when she got home. Yeah, I had a good day. I applied for 10 jobs. Only a beer at lunch. I'm so glad you're home. I was depressed. As the author Barbara Kingsolver said, there's no point treating a depressed person as though she were just feeling sad, saying, "There now, hang on, you'll get over it." Sadness is more or less like a head cold. With patience, it passes. Depression is like cancer.
Poison oak, some boyhood bravery. Telephone was a tin can on a string, and I fell asleep with you still talking to me. You said you weren't afraid to die. Polaroids. dressed in women's clothes. Were you made ashamed? Why'd you lock them in a drawer? Well, I don't think that I ever loved you more.
The depression I know is a massive weight. It presses me into the bed and won't let me get up. It presses my tongue down and won't let me speak, even to those I love. It sinks my heart into my feet, useless. But mainly, it turns my mind into a rock. A rock that sees no point in showering, in eating, in asking for aid, in doing anything that might help me. They say that depression lies, but for me, depression told me a truth, a fundamental truth, that I was worthless with no right to be alive. This is the hardest part of depression to explain to muggles. I fully believe everything my depressed mind tells me. It is as real as the snot dripping from my nose. And even when the spell is broken, I still look back and think, well, depression did have some interesting points. They say that depression lies, but the fucking problem is that most of me thinks that depression is the only one that tells the truth. The depression I know can last for days or months or years. They say depression is invisible, but depression, when it hits me, is etched all over my face. I've been called a different person, a light gone out, a toy that lost its batteries, whatever cliche you want to use for a broken person trapped in a room and surrounded by people his mind forces him to hate. Depression is letting your beloved garden slowly die and not caring. Depression is letting a cherished love wither on the vine and not crying. Depression is being an asshole. It's not respecting your partner, not sympathizing how hard this must be on them too, not making steps to seek the help you need, turning away the help that is offered. And having depression is not an excuse for any of those things. Mental illness is never an excuse for being an asshole. The world's just too complicated for that. And yet, I'm the one with a 50-cent stare and a barely functioning nervous system.
The end of paralysis. I was a statue. Now I'm drunk as hell on a piano bench. And when I press the keys, it all gets reversed. The sound of love.
They say that happiness is the opposite of depression. Again, I see it differently. To me, productivity is the opposite of depression. Depression empties you, letting you believe that inaction is the only way you'll live down to its feelings of worthlessness. But getting up, taking a shower, going to work, these are the true victories of the depressed. Tending the garden, tending the relationship, functioning again, recognizing yourself in the mirror, offering up a 50-cent smile, and getting a little change in return. This is the hallowed winning circle of the depressed. It's hard to explain how depression happens, but for me, it goes something like this. It's like a wave, I guess, if a wave could both hold you down just under the water and smash you against the rocks at the same time. But usually you just wake up with it one day. Maybe something is going on in your life. Maybe it isn't. Maybe you feel that sick surf lapping at your toes and you know you're going under. You bargain with yourself for a few more minutes in bed. You already know it will turn into a few more hours. Pulling the sheet up takes more strength than you normally drop on leg day. Your mind starts yelling things that you believe about yourself, but would never tell anyone else. Gentler things at first, then full-on Angelica in the playpen bully mode. They won't miss you at work. They'll be fine without you. Your work doesn't matter much anyway. I mean, if you were better, or more outgoing, or talk to the boss more, well, maybe that'd be different. But not you. They probably won't even notice that you're gone. So you decide not to go to work, and you get a brief boost of serotonin as that burden falls off your shoulders. though just curls in a guilt at the bottom of your feet. And then the voices roar back. You can't even go to work. I bet you can't even shower. You don't deserve to shower. You're filthy. You deserve to be filthy. Why ever get clean? No one wants to go out with you. No one wants to be seen with you. No one wants to fuck you. They never will. So why put on clothes? Why shower? Why try at all? You're hungry, sort of, but really it's a dull hurt in your stomach. But what are you going to eat? Lucky Charms? You're 28 years old and you still eat Lucky Charms, like an idiot child. Everyone else knows so much more about the world than you do. They all have spouses who know how to make pancakes from scratch. They make them every morning as their perfect kid runs around their perfect house. You'll never have that. You can't even get a date, even on Tinder. You're so fucking ugly that you can't get a date on Tinder. You may as well stay in bed. Your writing, your guitar playing, your drawings. Have you seen them? You're no Hemingway, no Dylan, no Georgia O'Keeffe. Not even close. You never will be. Why even try? The check hanging up from your first paid writing gig ages yellow and sad on the wall. You thought it would be the first of many. It will be your first and only. Why try? You may as well sleep. It's honestly all you're good for. And what happens now is a dangerous cycle, because while productivity is depression's foil, not eating, not getting up and moving around, not fulfilling responsibilities, all leads to more depression, more ammo for the voices in your head. The voices that you are sure are the only ones who really know the real you. So you don't return calls or texts from friends or loved ones because you know they're lying. You know they don't care because just objectively on paper, who would care about you? You still eat Lucky Charms. You can't even go to work. If people knew the real you, they never want to hang out with you. So you push them away as a preemptive strike. And the cycle can go on. Maybe you pull out of it wholesale, like a bad dream. Wake up and see yourself as you are, capable, flawed, but worthy. But more likely, you take one step. You eat the Lucky Charms. Despite the influx of artificial sugar, it starts to nourish you. You turn on the TV and watch BoJack Horseman. You relate to his sadness, but not his misogyny. And that surfaces empathy, which in turn gives you a small amount of sympathy for yourself. You call someone. When you are productivity-minded, you discuss what your depression looks like with them. They come over with soup and a Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan edit of The Lord of the Rings. They walk you to the shower and turn on the water. You gain enough energy to do the rest. You work through it. It's hard. The voices are still there. It takes marathons of energy just to talk. But you do it. You break the cycle. You embrace productivity. And the noonday demon is sated for another day.
It's different when you're lonely. The whole world's in love. Holding hands. Between bar stools, and you're holding your tongue. Hold on, you're so fucked up, you're so fickle.
This is a slightly different episode, as I'll be talking about depression and mental illness through the songs of many different artists. But I'm still David Callison, and this. This is the sound of the story.
But it's different when you're helpless. When the bars close the doors, growing hostile towards your waitress. Those extra tips that were ignored.
Depression, perhaps for cruelty's sake, is often viciously competitive. It's like that creature in Harry Potter that morphs into an image of your worst fear. A Bogart, I think it's called. Depression is like a Bogart in your brain. Every pair of happy, healthy people in the world come off as a deeply personal insult. And that's exactly what Tim Kasher, lead singer of Cursive, The Good Life, and his own solo work, and part of the original Saddle Creek crew, describes in his early Good Life cut, O'Rourke's 1:20 AM. And for those playing the home game, O'Rourke's is a real bar, still open, in Kasher's native Omaha. It's different when you're lonely. The whole world's in love, holding hands between bar stools, and you're holding your tongue. When you're depressed, everyone else has everything you want. But it's different when you're helpless, when the bars close their doors, which they do 40 minutes after this song takes place. Growing hostile toward your waitress, whose extra tips you ignore. A double meaning here. He ignored tipping his waitress, so now she's angry. But he also ignored her tips, her advice, on how to be less miserable. He's regretting both of those choices now. Your eyes can't disguise it, so glassy, half empty, ready to spill. The loneliness and his drunkenness show in his eyes, which are glassed over and look pessimistic. That's the glass half empty that's ready to spill because of his inebriation. But also he's near crying, his eyes red and ready to spill tears. Finally, he asks the oncoming pedestrians to hold on to me. I can hardly stand, much less the sight of myself. He can hardly remain upright, much less tolerating himself or how he feels. In the sequel to this song, set an hour later, we learn that he does get a ride with a woman who refuses to acknowledge how much you can't stand who I am. I've been trying to tell you that I've been a terrible man. If you listen, you can hear the sound of 1,000 girlfriends rolling their eyes at that line. Like I said, depression is complicated. But imagine being in love with someone bent solely on self-destruction, who despite your pleas, keeps spouting depression's central dogma. I am a terrible man. Gets old after a while, trust me. So hold on. Hold on tight to put your foot on the gas. Get me the fuck out of here. Laura Jane Grace is the lead singer of Against Me and recently dropped her first solo record. Also, if you're a fan of this podcast and punk music at all, you should check out her excellent memoir, Tranny, about her transition to becoming a woman and her life in a punk band. In this song, aptly titled Manic Depression, she spells out with a lazy guitar line exactly what her manic depression looks like. A note on definitions here. At some point, doctors realized that they should probably name these afflictions that were invisible on the outside, you know, no runny nose, no rashes, but very real on the inside. So eventually they gave them names like depression or major depressive disorder and manic depression or bipolar disorder. Further distinguishing that is class 1 or class 2, depending on its severity. And there's all the others, of course, right? General anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, borderline personality disorder, et cetera, et cetera. Throw addiction into that mix, you've got a whole interwoven clusterfuck of illnesses that take place inside your head. But doctors like specific diagnoses that it helps them know what game plan to use to treat the patient. And look, a diagnosis can be very powerful. When I was first diagnosed in 2006 with major depressive disorder, I felt justified and less alone. When I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder 6 years later, and yeah, I'd been seeing a psych and a therapist the whole time. These things are messy and tricky. I felt a deep satisfaction that my abnormal behavior had a name, had a reason. A diagnosis can also get you the help, psychiatrically and therapeutically, that you need to get better. But no person is alike, and no disorder looks alike. You may have never been diagnosed, but relate to everything I'm saying here. That's fine. You may be diagnosed and not agree with any of this, and that's fine too. From my view, however you want to identify or not, it's fine. I tend to stick with bipolar because I've experienced all its symptoms at some point. And one of the things folks don't realize about bipolar is that it's marked not only by periods of mania, but by periods of chronic, unprovoked depression. Depression spells out of nowhere with no environmental cause. But honestly, mental illness can kind of do whatever it wants. Bipolar, for instance, was brought up in Western medicine in 1850 when it was called La Folie Circulaire, Circular Insanity. It wasn't added to the big book of American diagnoses called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, until 1980. So, you know, labels. Anyway, here's Laura Jane on what her illness, which she calls manic depression, sounds like. We'll be right back. Something or someone to keep me sane, otherwise I'm gonna waste another day. Stare at my fucking phone, think about everyone and everything I fucking hate, and how life is never gonna change. You can hear the frustration and inertia we talked about earlier. I'm not sure what I look forward to anymore, but I welcome sleep, and only will smoking weed kill the dread and anxiety. I try to recognize privilege present, and I'm thankful for good fortune. I don't want to sound ungrateful, like I can't see the good going. Depression can be both existentially boring and a constant low-level stream of panic. Imagine when you're lying awake in bed thinking about work, but instead of knowing you're going to get up and tackle it all the next morning, you know you won't be able to get out of bed, which then further adds to the panic. But I can't help what my head is telling me. I can't stop myself from listening. Manic depression, yeah. Endless obsessions, yeah. We've talked a lot about that voice that depression has. Another element Grace introduces here is the endless obsession. Part of my manic phases are endless loops of thought, like an animated GIF in my head playing over and over and over again. I need something or someone to relieve the tension and anxiety, give me sex or drugs or destruction, some kind of excitement, please, even if it's terrifying. Shake or smack the shit out of me. Turn me upside down, otherwise I'm going to drink and drink and drink. Well, there could be a whole podcast just about that verse, but the idea Grace is presenting here is that depression leaves her so numb, she's often drawn to an extreme behavior just to cut through all the listlessness and apathy. This is often the source of self-harm, usually cutting, with someone wanting to just feel something physically, even pain, that matches how they feel on the inside. As Johnny Resnick said, yeah, you bleed just to know you're alive. And if you can't cope in other ways, you can always drink. And drinking while depressed is like shooting a snake in your boat. It's going to help solve the immediate problem, but now you have a fucking hole in your boat.
I'm singing at a funeral tomorrow for a kid a year older than me, and I've been talking to his dad. It makes me so sad when I think too much about it. I can't breathe, and I have this dream where I'm screaming underwater while my friends are waving from the shore. I don't need you to tell me what that means. I don't believe in that stuff anymore. Jesus Christ, I'm so blue all the time, and that's just how I feel. Always have, and I always will. I always have, and always will. Talk until we think we might just kill. John's kid is dead. Jesus Christ, I'm so blue all the time.
With Phoebe Bridgers, friend of fellow sad songstress Julian Baker and Lucy Dacus, and Bridgers' idol, the late Elliot Smith, contemplate the barely permeable layer between self-hatred and self-preservation. Bridgers sings, I'm singing at a funeral tomorrow for a kid a year older than me, and I've been talking to his dad. It makes me so sad. When I think too much about it, I can't breathe. And then she lays out a depressive landscape, including a dream where she's drowning and all her friends are waving to her from the shore. She talks about calling her friend when she feels so depressed she wants to die, and then breaking through that feeling with laughter. Finally, she talks about blacking out and waking up in her childhood bed, presumably at her parents' house, a sign of a deep and serious breakdown, and remembering the funeral she has to sing at tomorrow. This cycle of self-loathing, self-pity, and guilt is common in depression. She's clearly feeling depressed and hopeless as she sings in the chorus, Jesus Christ, I'm so blue all the time, and that's just how I feel, always have, and always will. She flirts with the notion of death, of not existing, but real-world responsibilities and tragedies pull her back into the land of the living. This whole song is about that contradictory feeling of being sad about someone else's death, but not giving yourself that same sympathy, that same respect. She notes, too, that it's 4 a.m, a time reserved for sleep or destructive rumination. Similarly, in 2:45 a.m., Elliot Smith reacts to an abusive home situation in Portland. It's Lad's Circle that he refers to towards the end when he says, I'm walking out on Center Circle. He talks about his outward anger towards his stepfather. I'm looking for the man that attacked me. While acknowledging the silent pain pulling him apart, with hidden cracks that don't show, but that constantly grow. Just like Bridgers, Smith wakes up after a blackout. And just like Bridgers, he mentions the specific time of his despair, 2:45 in the morning, and he's looking for someone to wave off the demons of his past and present. Of course, just as Bridgers comes full circle to confront the pain from a death in her life, even as she eyes her own death, Smith confronts the vicious codependency. You beat it in me, that part of you, but I'm going to split us back in two. By dreaming of getting entangled with yet another person to protect him. Looking for somebody's arms to wave away past harms. Both of you can just fade to black. Walking out on Center Circle. Pushed away and I'll never come back. Suicide is a difficult but important subject to talk about. Scientists think 50 to 70% of suicide victims have a history of mental illness. That might seem obvious, but suicide was often thought of as a decision of passion in reaction to a life tragedy like a divorce, losing of a job, etc. According to my insurance provider, my life expectancy dropped a full decade when I was diagnosed bipolar due to the commonality of suicide in people with the illness. Suicide is the second leading cause of death in Americans under the age of 34. Men are three times as likely to kill themselves as women, in part because men are more than twice as likely to attempt it with a firearm, which is much more likely to be fatal. Suicide is difficult to study because we can't talk to any of its victims about it. Suicide is depression's extreme, an emotional pain and hurt so acute that it becomes literally unbearable. And despite greater resources and awareness, the suicide rate has increased 25% since the turn of the century. On May 9th of this year, the Twitter account for the band Frightened Rabbits posted the following message. "We are worried about Scott, who has been missing for a little while now. He may be in a fragile state and may not be making the best decisions for himself right now. Please, could Scott or anyone with any information on his whereabouts, please contact Police Scotland." Scott was Scott Hutchinson, beloved lead singer of indie band Frightened Rabbit. The previous night, he had tweeted out, "Be so good to everyone you love. It's not a given. I'm so annoyed that it's not. I didn't live by that standard, and it kills me. Please hug your loved ones." 19 minutes later, he tweeted, "I'm away now. Thanks." Scott's body was found 2 days later floating on the banks of the River Forth in Scotland, underneath the Forth Road Bridge. As you'll hear in this song, which I'll play in its entirety, this idea was not a new one for Scott. Here, and floating in the Forth, he contemplates suicide in the same spot his body was found, though in the song he was able to set the urge aside. Depression is tenacious and unrelenting. And this is where depression does indeed lie. Because it convinces you that the world and your loved ones would be better off without you. And that is never the case. That is a lie, always. Here's Floating in the Forth in its entirety. I'll let Scott's words speak for themselves.
So you just step out of the front of my house and I'll never see you again. I closed my eyes for a second and when they opened you weren't there. And the door shut, I was vacuum packed, shrink wrapped out of air. And the spine collapsed and the eyes rolled back to stare at my starving brain. And fully clothed, I'll float away. Suicide for another day. And I picture this corpse on the Emmy hearse and a half run away to sleep on a rolled up coat against the window with the strobe of the sun and the life I've led. I'm ready to leap into peace beneath the roar of the Forth Road Bridge. On the northern side is a fief of mine and a boat in the port for me.
Save suicide for another year.
In a review of Cassavetes' opening night, one critic said that star Gina Rowlands was so powerful because she allowed herself to be ugly on screen. Not in a physical sense, but in an emotional sense, raw, vulnerable, mean, tested. My friend Luke Rainsford does the same thing with his music. Luke writes beautiful, soul-bearing music and plays it to hundreds of screaming girls in the West Midlands of England, a national pastime over there, I'm told. The only time I'm happy is when I'm drunk or having sex, but I'm repulsive and broke, so I hurt myself instead, he sings. We are our harshest critic, and depression reads us these one-star reviews back to us loudly and with an authority it never earned. I feel numb, my body is broken, I'm a skeleton, be my skin. I'll be the frame in which you stretch yourself out. Does the thought of me ever stress you out? Oh, Luke, it's a top 10 lyric right there. Does the thought of me ever stress you out? Because it gets to the idea of feeling like a burden to the other people around you. Depression is heavy, even when someone else is helping to carry that load. And I'll say something here because I have felt like a burden before. And this isn't the part where I tell you that I actually wasn't a burden, and that we should never think like that. Because, well, depression is complicated, remember? For a large part of my life, I was a burden on those around me. My past is littered with self-harming episodes and suicide attempts. And each time there was a brother, a parent, a significant other that had to clean up the mess. That's just the reality. The thought of me stressed people out. That doesn't make it my fault. But it doesn't make it untrue either.
But you always know that I'm trying so hard to get better. Soon be better for you. Insecure, you're so careful and pure. You're untouched by this world and its evil. You want to travel the earth, be a handsome man's girl, go and meet some interesting people. Then you open the door and let someone like me in. Ruined it all. I was lonely and desperate for someone or something to love me as much as I wished I loved anything. Heart for this anymore. I try to write songs, but they're not good enough. I've been thinking about death this week. I've been thinking about death. I'm a mess, but you always know how to clean me up. Get me off of the floor of this bedroom that I made my home. It's a mess, but you always know that I'm trying so hard to get better.
When I tell people that I left my ex-wife primarily because she didn't want to take care of someone who was depressed, they usually give the same moan of disgust and pity. But imagine for a second, you're the wife waking up at 4 a.m. to find your husband naked on the couch with a kitchen knife kissing his wrist. The person you love more than anything. Your husband. Physically hurting himself. That's hard. That sucks. So look, everyone around you absolutely, resolutely wants you to stick around. But to pretend that it doesn't affect those around us is foolish at best. The thought of me probably still does stress somebody out. But that certainly doesn't mean they love me any less. And that doesn't mean that it's my fault when I have a depressive episode. It's just the messy reality. And I think it's important to think about that. That's what Luke articulates so well here. Fuck a shoulder to cry on. I'll give you my body to burn. I'll cry enough for both of us, because I know how these flames hurt. This masochistic version of love, as Luke points out, is based on someone else. And even though they say you shouldn't get sober just for someone else or want to get better just for someone else, we are often motivated by our loved ones. And while I know that I can reach out, lean on, rest on, drape myself on these people around me, I also know that they're human too. Luke ends the song with, "I could die happy tonight with the knowledge that you were alive." And while he might die happy, he'd still be dead. And she doesn't want to live in a world without Luke. I don't either. That's why the only advice I've ever been sure about giving is stay alive. Just stay alive. The subject of medication inevitably rises in the broader conversation about mental health. There are thousands of medicines out there that affect how our brain produces and interprets hormones and other chemicals that affect mood. One class of drugs, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that's your Prozac, Zolofts, Paxils, latch onto the serotonin receptors and block them, tricking your brain into making more. Serotonin is one of the chemicals in our brain linked to feelings of happiness and contentment. It is important to remember that regardless of your feelings about medication, the discovery of SSRIs in the 80s was one of the greatest achievements in medical history, allowing doctors to treat mood disorders with medication basically for the first time. Before that, antidepressants had the nasty side effect of causing seizures. It was a revolution. Similarly, lithium was a game changer for the treatment of bipolar and manic-based illnesses. Now, these medications also have side effects. For the SSRIs, it can be drowsiness, weight fluctuation, dizziness, and sexual problems like reduced or absent libido and an inability to maintain an erection. Getting fat and not being able to get it up always seemed like a very depressing way to cure depression. Also, SSRIs, when stopped, can cause massive withdrawals. I went to the hospital one time coming off Lexapro. And there is strong evidence that mental health medication is overprescribed and underobserved, causing bad situations to get worse instead of better. And there's the stacking of medications. Zoloft with a little Wellbutrin and Xanax on the side. Lithium, Latuda, Lamictal, oh my. I've been on so many of them. It's trendy these days to tell medication horror stories, side effects stacking up on the side effects, pill-pushing psychiatrists blasé behind their mahogany desks. But medications do save lives. It gives back the functionality that depression and other illnesses take away. The issue is complicated, absolutely. I like the Motion City soundtrack line, "I believe in medication, and I believe in therapy, and I believe in crystal light, because I believe in me." Yeah. Artists, I think, are especially wary of anything that will hinder their creativity, and the myth of the tortured artist that pain is required to make good art is deeply entrenched. Patrick Stickles, the bipolar force behind Titus Andronicus, struggles with this in his song No Future Part 3, Escape from No Future. He describes feeling nervous and isolated, imprisoned by a dark sense of dread. He says, all I want for Christmas is no feelings. No feelings now and never again. Well, careful what you wish for. Because then we flash to him after he's taken his medication, probably including lithium, which is very powerful and can be hard to manage. And he feels like he's given up a part of himself. This is a common sentiment, especially in bipolar people who mourn the loss of the intense energy of mania. Remember Laura Jane talking about how she wanted something electrifying, even if it was terrifying, just something to feel? That's very common in bipolar people. I used to look myself in the mirror at the end of every day, but I took the one thing that made me beautiful and I threw it away. I was a river, I was a tall tree, I was a volcano, but now I'm asleep on top of a mountain. I've been covered in snow. He was flowing, natural, bursting, and I was under piles of snow, cold and frozen. This zombie-like effect can trap people in a world where an unmedicated life is too explosive and dangerous, but a medicated one is too lethargic and robotic. This is what the movie Garden State alludes to when the main character decides to go off his lithium, as he felt it made him disconnected to the real world. In the movie, this is successful, and he gets to spoon Natalie Portman while the Postal Service plays. But some people I know, if they go off their lithium, they go and drive a car down a freeway at 100 miles per hour and steal money from the till at Target. So again, it's complicated and a difficult balance to find. And Garden State has recently been criticized for glorifying mental illness. Stickles continues with his struggle. Yes, I have surrendered what made me human of all that I thought was true. So now there's a robot that lives in my brain and he tells me what to do. And I can do nothing without his permission, which wasn't part of the plan. So now in a Rock Ridge pharmacy, I'll be waiting for my man. He laments this feeling of inhumanity the drug gives him, but in the end, he's still waiting at that pharmacy in New Jersey. Why? Because there's a destructive, mean voice inside him that keeps shouting, "You will always be a loser." And for Patrick, dealing with side effects, as bad as they can get sometimes, is worth shutting up that insufferable voice. One thing that's happened over the past decade is that the awareness and acceptance of mental illness has increased. What used to be a massive stigma is now, well, a smaller stigma. But artists especially are speaking directly and plainly about these issues in a way we haven't heard before. Here's Emily, who comprises the band Local News Legend, with a song from her YouTube channel called "I Wrote This When I Was Super Mentally Bad a Few Months Ago, Tear Face Emoticon." Here's the whole thing. It's pretty short.
Mental health is shit.
I love her honesty. She talks about ideas that we've covered here, like not believing that she is worth the love and praise of her friends. She references a song she related to in eighth grade, The Westerner, by Falling in Reverse, a post-hardcore emo band. She cops a line from that song, too. I feel the madness creeping slowly. Loved by many, I'm still lonely. That lyric reminds me of a sarcastic line from Mr. Jones by The Counting Crows. When everybody loves you, you can never be lonely. Emily's honesty and her specificity in describing her own pain actually makes it more universal and more relatable. That, in essence, is the thesis of this entire podcast. That sharing the personal specifics of your struggles and pain, far from alienating people, makes it that much more relatable. There was a sign at the outpatient program where I got sober that had a man washing his car in the pouring rain. The caption says, "When you deal with being sad by listening to sad music." Fuck that. My whole life is the opposite of that.
And I'm not trying to keep bringing this up. My stupid brain, it starts and I won't shut up.
Gelozo currently leads the band Jetty Bones. She's been in a bunch of other bands, but Jetty Bones recently released a new song, Bringing It Up, that I think is a good one to go out on. She laments the difficulty of bringing up mental illnesses with a significant other, saying, "And I'm afraid if I should say what's on my mind, my security blanket will unravel with time." As much as we want others in our life to understand our illness, it often makes us uncomfortable to share. We lose the protection, the ambiguity that mental illness affords us. If I act selfish or mean, hey, that's just the bipolar talking, not me. Yeah, sure. Keeping our illness hidden also protects us from the very doubts that depression shouts so loudly. If I share this vulnerability with you and you reject it, all those voices were right. I am a loser. I will always be a loser. I don't deserve love. Everyone says that ignorance is bliss, she sings. But I don't think that applies to this. She ends with the image of her pacing in her kitchen with her bedroom, but she says she's getting close to getting to the porch. The porch here, protected and still part of the house, but accessible to the outside world, is an ideal level of vulnerability for her. We don't have to invite everyone all the way into the house, but nor should we keep them completely locked out. We should meet them on the porch. I'm moving to the porch soon, I swear. I'm moving to the porch soon.
Slim, slow, slide up. Horsey ride. And white as snow. Slim, slow, slide up. Horsey ride. White as snow. Tell it everywhere you go. Saw you walking down by Ladbroke Grove this morning.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I know it was different, but it felt like the right way to tackle a subject that's important to me. We'll have your regular album deep dive next episode. If you're struggling with mental illness and need help, please reach out to someone, anyone. PsychologyToday.com has a huge therapist database sorted by location, insurance, and specialty. It's the best I've seen. Of course, if you are ever feeling suicidal, please call 1-800-273-8255. Put it in your phone as Obi-Wan so you can call it when it's your only hope. The best literary depiction I've read of depression is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, and the best memoir of bipolar I've read is An Unquiet Mind by Kay Redfield Jamison. My favorite film on this subject is It's Kind of a Funny Story. You can follow me on Twitter at David Callison, KALLISON, and you can write in to dcallison@mac.com. Special shout out to Devin, who reminded me that this song, Van Morrison's Slim So Slider, is the greatest depression song of all time. This whole episode goes out to my friend Andrew. We were childhood friends, and he taught me a lot. He taught me a lot about how the world works. He died in a car accident last week, and so this one goes out to him. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay alive.
And I know you know it too. I know you're dying, and I know you know it too. Every time I see you, I just don't know what to do.